Hello, scribes, scribblers, and scriptologists. I'm Grant Faulkner, searcher for the holy grail of how to write the perfect novel, or even just an adequate novel. And I'm here with my co-host, Brooke Warner. And Brooke, I have a challenge for you. In researching today's guest, Donald Moss, who is many things, he's a writer, an agent, a teacher, and a mentor. I read this quote by him that I thought was a pretty good way to think of writing a story, no matter if it's a novel or a memoir, and his advice comes in just one sentence. He said, "The first task in building a compelling story world is to create hope." And I paused to think about that, and I tried to think of a good story that didn't have a sense of hope. I thought of several very, very dark novels, and I think all of them still have a sense of hope in them, and that Donald is right, that the compelling ingredient is hope. It's hope that makes these stories work, even the darkest of novels. I mean, even Raskolnikov in Crime and Punishment, who is dark in so many ways and is self-destructive and a murderer, but there's still a sense of hope for him and in him. There's even a very saintly character, Sonia, who loves him, and the novel ends with the hope that the two of them can kindle their love and find happiness in the comfort of one another. I'm curious if you know of a novel or a memoir where the idea of hope is absent. And if not, what is a story that constructs a world out of hope in an interesting, surprising, perhaps counterintuitive way, such as Crime and Punishment?
Well, I'll take the challenge of the former, because actually two novels do come to mind, both of which impacted me in seriously disturbing ways, and that's why they're so easily and readily accessible. The first one is American Psycho, which is a super relevant novel, by the way, about the vapid and destructive nature of capitalism and what happens to people when they don't value other human beings, and about the mind of a person so consumed with material things and who's so narcissistic that he engages in all of this rampant objectification and brutalization, in his case of women. But, you know, I digress. The novel ends, however, with this notion of whether any of it is true. Right? That's what sticks with you. Is it all in Patrick Bateman's mind, or did he actually do all of these terrible things? So there's that. I don't know if that is particularly hopeful. It certainly struck me as just, it ended and I was like, yikes. So then another one that sticks out for me is Requiem for a Dream, which is another one of the most disturbing novels of all times. And I won't go into the plot for readers. Just suffice it to say, it's a drug novel, that's very centered on sort of the hopelessness of what happens when someone gets into the drug world and then gets addicted to their own product. And the mother in the story is a complete mess who, you know, doesn't really have a good ending. So I guess the thing is that there's a place for those kinds of books. I do think they're few and far between, but they stand out to me as books that I'm not totally sure I'm glad I read. And maybe that's a point for listeners to consider as well. Like, if you're a writer, what kind of emotion do you want to evoke? And what's the point of the reading experience for your reader? Because for sure, the novels that I mostly gravitate to would absolutely have some kind of hopeful center or hopeful ending. And I also think that those are the kinds of books that make for more commercial novels.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Thank you for mentioning those books, because now I'm intrigued. I'm going to have to read them. I've seen each of them as in their movie treatment. I totally get what you're mentioning in terms of lacking a sense of hope. And I definitely think you're right with American Psycho, which was written out of a certain kind of misanthropic nihilism. It brings to mind that some writers actually write with this purpose to undermine hope, in short, or to kind of show the hopelessness of, or their dark view of the hopelessness of the human condition, which, yeah, I guess it has a place. I thought of Kafka's Metamorphosis as well, because there's perhaps no story quite as hopeless as Gregor Samson, the main character, turning into a cockroach and being othered in all ways from life, you know. But then I thought about how the whole story, it does have hope, because there's hope that he'll find a way out of his predicament. And there are many redeeming moments of human kindness within it, even though he does die in the end. So I don't think it fits into that nihilistic genre of American Psycho. Yeah, it's all interesting to think about, because one of the reasons I like Donald Moss's emphasis on hope is that I think we can all get caught up in learning the writerly parts of writing, the craft parts, and he emphasizes that readers don't read for sparkly prose necessarily, or writerly flourishes, or even head-spinning plot twists, but they read for emotional experience. He says, why is it important to look at fiction writing through the lens of emotional experience? Because that's the way readers read. They don't so much read as respond. And I love thinking about stories in this way, through an emotional lens, through this pursuit of hope. But at the same time, I wonder about the how of it. And I wonder if the how can be explained. I recently read a quote from Tennessee Williams who said, "I have a theory that the best books aren't created through an expertise of craft, but through an author's courage to be vulnerable." And I think that's the only way I know how to describe the how of writing with hope, to muster the courage to be vulnerable on the page and to identify what elements of hope you want to focus on. Brooke, in your work with memoirs, you must come up with this challenge, how to properly calibrate the level of hope and how to make sure there's the proper balance of emotions in the story.
Yeah, for sure. And I'm glad you bring this up, because if a memoirist tries to sell a book that's just a despairing story of all the terrible things that happened in their lives with no redemption, no transformation, no sense that the author came out the other side okay, or at least more or less intact, then I would argue that that book would not sell, you know, not to publishers and not to readers. So on the one hand, I do think there's a market for disturbing books. I actually appreciate what you said, that maybe, you know, the lack of hope is actually the purpose of a book like American Psycho, right? To upend our assumptions about things. And maybe we want to be disturbed when we read that kind of fiction. But I don't think that's true for memoir. You know, readers do like to experience a broad range of human emotions, including the messy parts. But in memoir, you do not want your reader to carry the burden of taking care of you or actively worrying about whether you're ultimately going to be okay. So, you know, on the one hand, you could argue, yes, he or she is okay because they live to tell the story of the book. But memoir at the end of the day is about transformation and how an author grows or changes. So in memoir, the through line of hope is maybe even more present or necessary than it is for novels, in my opinion. So I love that we're exploring it across genres.
Yeah. You know, I thank you for that. It's interesting to think about the role of hope in memoirs compared to novels. And I also recently read this quote by one of my favorite writers, Rebecca Solnit. She said, "The tricky thing about hope is not to confuse it with optimism." And I thought that was just so fascinating to ponder, because it's a really interesting balancing act to have a story that reflects a world that's dark or pessimistic, but to write about it with an affirming hope. And it made me think about another dark novel. I think, you know, some of my favorite novels are very dark. Malcolm Lowry's Under the Volcano, where he presents a very pessimistic view of human nature. And one of the novel's many messages is a critique of the fascism that was gaining traction in the 1930s. So the alcoholic world of the main character was, you know, spinning around darkness and lovelessness in the world in so many ways. But the whole novel is also a quest to return to a state of love, to reclaim it and find a way to live with it. And that takes place mainly in the main character's many failed attempts to reconcile with his wife. You know, it's an absolutely dark novel in so many ways, and the main character ends up dying. And so it's not optimistic in any sense, but there it is still built on hope. And I guess that's what I keep returning to, is thinking about how we can structure our narratives around hope. And I like this idea of building a novel on hope more than other shorthand ideas for successful writing that I've read. For example, I think of Nabokov. I think of this quote a lot. He said, "A writer may be considered as a storyteller, as a teacher, and as an enchanter." And that's that a major writer combines all three, storyteller, teacher, and enchanter. But it is the enchanter that should predominate, he said. And I've always been, I don't know, confused by that, I guess, and pondered it. Focusing on enchantment has always led me to think that I need to have an enchanting voice or an enchanting style, you know, writerly stuff. But I'm now going to interpret that quote as meaning that a writer's enchantment comes from the way hope is handled in a story.
Yeah, what a great reframe, Grant. And just finding that right word that works for you to plug into the directive that Nabokov was trying to give is great, because maybe that's exactly what he meant. You know,
yeah,
I can see, I can see how hope is woven into enchantment, in the sense that anyone who can offer me hope or inspire me with hope when I'm otherwise disillusioned or worse, you know, listless, devastated, despairing, is an enchantress. And most people do read to escape into another experience, of course, or maybe to find truth, or maybe just to feel. So I love it. And let's see what Dawn's take is on all this. We are going to leave all of you for a few brief moments to ponder upon the ways in which you may experience enchantment. Is hope in the mix?
Welcome back, everybody. I'm excited about today's guest, Dawn Moss. He's interesting to me in that he wears many hats. He's an agent, an author mentor, and a teacher, and probably more. He founded the Donald Moss Literary Agency in New York in 1980. He's the author of a number of great writing books, including The Career Novelist, Writing the Breakout Novel, The Fire in Fiction, The Breakout Novelist, Writing 21st Century Fiction, and The Emotional Craft of Fiction, which I particularly like. And he leads writing workshops around the country. And on the latter note, a NaNoWriMo writer actually took one of these workshops and immediately wrote to me and to say that he'd be a great guest on this podcast. So we're happy to have him. Welcome, Dawn.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Well, I'm curious about your journey in the world of writing. You wrote a lot of fiction as well in your early agenting days, I read, in both the romance and the young adult genres. So I'm curious about your journey from writer to owner of an agency to teacher. It's a somewhat unique cast of roles.
Wow. Well, I actually started inside publishing. I worked at Dell Publishing, the paperback company, long ago. I was a junior editor, but then made the transition into the agency world. I hung out my own shingle before too long and had neglected to actually line up clients whose work I could sell. So I needed to make a living. I was reading manuscripts for editor friends, writing readers' reports, and then had the opportunity to do some work for a book packaging company and wound up writing, by the end of it all, 14 novels. Mm. There's a well-known teenage sleuth who has been around for many years. I wrote some novels in that series. I wrote some romance fiction as well. And, you know, It was an unusual path that I took, but I'm very, very glad that I did, because it put me on the other side of the desk and I found out what it's like to be an author, to hear editorial comments that are, you know, sometimes painful or with which you might disagree. The process and what you go through to actually put a novel together gave me a lot of insight into the, you know, the life and practice and minds of novelists. And that's not only made me a better agent, I think, more empathetic agent, but also has given me a lot of orientation to the craft itself. And, you know, all these years later, I've written a number of books on the craft. I continue to think and delve into the craft. I'm writing yet another new book about it now. It's been a great multifaceted journey. And, you know, I'm unusual, the path I took, but has worked out really, really well for me. It's made me better at everything, I think.
Hmm. Well, Dawn, you have two books, Writing the Breakout Novel and Writing 21st Century Fiction, and you ask writers to be brave and write with honesty. And we often talk about that topic on this show, you know, just the need to be vulnerable, how readers connect to authenticity and how to be, you know, daring and honest in your writing and how that makes a powerful book. You mentioned craft, and this is maybe a supplement to craft or maybe more to do with writer's process. But I wonder if you can speak to writing honestly, because obviously it's easier said than done.
It's such a good question and really fundamental to the whole business of writing fiction. Particularly when we talk about genre fiction, fiction that follows known patterns, romance and mystery fiction, thrillers, horror fiction, things like that. You often hear that there are writing rules, that there are expectations that readers have that you need to meet. If you're writing a mystery novel, there really should be a dead body somewhere early in the story. And we ought to know by the end of the story whodunit. But those patterns and that body of literature take us to tropes and ways of handling both story and characters, even the intent of stories, the thematic content, if you will, that are safe, that are acceptable, easy to sell, easy to read, easy to understand. And those tropes, which extend, you know, even to characters and who they are and how they act and so forth, it's not that writing in a way that's comfortable for readers is wrong. It's not. It's not illegal or anything. But it also can create characters that are predictable, expected. And life isn't like that. We as human beings are on journeys, very unique journeys, each of us. And to connect to fiction in a way that really profoundly speaks to us, that really grips us, we have to be honest and authentic. That's another word that people use. And what that means is breaking out of the boxes that genre fiction in particular, but even literary fiction too, can put us in terms of how characters are handled. To put it simply, I think a lot of writers play it safe. They play it safe in their storytelling. They play it safe with their characters. And that's okay. It's just that it doesn't make the deepest impact on us as we read. So what really is honesty? Honesty is going to places that are hard, emotional places that are surprising and difficult, things that are true to your experience, to my experience, to the author's experience, in ways that are sometimes uncomfortable, sometimes difficult, even painful to write. Honesty is taking a hard look at the world, at people, at ourselves, and writing about that without reservation, without any kind of filters or constraints. It's easy to say. It's a lot harder to do.
I love that guidance, Don. And it, you know, when we first corresponded, you mentioned that you were interested in talking about the topic of digging more out of a scene. So I'm kind of curious about how honesty relates to that. You said that layers of conflict might seem to slow one down, but in fact, they help generate more and richer scene content. Can you talk a little bit more about this and how you advise writers to dig more out of a scene and maybe how that relates to this topic of writing more honestly?
Sure. You know, I read a lot of manuscripts over the last, it's 40 years this year, I can't believe it. I don't know how many manuscripts I've read, thousands. In any event, scenes in manuscripts tend in general to run longer than they need to. Mm. It's not unusual for me to be reading a scene in a manuscript that even with a double-spaced page that runs 12, 15, sometimes even 20 or even 25 pages, that might seem like you've packed a lot into a scene, but actually in the reading, scenes seem dragged out. Now, why does that happen? You know, what in the process causes that sort of bloat that I see in manuscripts? Well, I think it's because writers enter a scene without really a clear or strong understanding of the intention of a scene. When you understand what a scene is intended to do and have a strategy for unfolding that purpose for a scene, the scene can get more tighter, more shapely, make its point and do its work in a more efficient way. A lot of people don't even know what kind of scene they're writing when they start. I mean, obviously, there are many different kinds of scenes depending on the type of story you're writing. But basically, all scenes break down into one of three categories. They either change the plot circumstances, or they change a character, or they change a relationship. And even determining that very fundamental intention of the scene when you begin can shape it in a better way. We also get some advice like determine the point of view character's goal in the scene. And you know, that's not wrong. It's just that the word goal takes us to some thinking that is very, very plot oriented. But there are lots of different kinds of goals. A goal is anything that a character wants or needs or has to get or avoid. That tends to take us to plot. But it can also mean what he or she doesn't understand or what lacks. What a character needs to learn or see or discover. Or it may be about two characters and what they need from each other. There are lots of different ways to understand that sort of generic term goal. And again, if you know those things as you begin a scene, the scene is already starting to take some shape. So I guess what I'm saying here is that writing honestly, to get back to your question, Grant, is that instead of approaching a scene thinking, what are the requirements of my genre for this scene? What's the template that I need to follow? the deeper and the better question to ask, I think, is what do my characters need? What are they really, truly seeking right now at this moment in the chronology of the story? That can be a little harder to dig out, but when you do, the scene finds an emotional basis, not just a plot basis, but an emotional basis that makes the scene more gripping to begin with. Lots of different things, but essentially honesty in scene construction means digging below the templates for scene to what characters need and what characters may sometimes secretly need. Now, that's the subtext. Hmm. We could spend an hour.
That's what I was going to say. It's so fascinating. And it just reminds our listeners, I think, of how much there really is to learn about craft. I do want to pivot a little bit because I know our listeners also are super interested in the publishing side. And since you do wear all these hats, you can speak to all these things, which is pretty exciting. I was hoping that you might speak a little bit to the query letter and how to write a good query. And specifically, could you give us a picture of what happens when you're sitting there as an agent and a new query letter comes in? What's that experience for you and what are you looking for? What would make you keep reading or request the first 50 pages?
Well, I've read more queries than I have manuscripts, and that's a lot. So yeah, I can speak to query letters. Or today, query emails, that old-fashioned posted query letter with the self-addressed stamped envelope enclosed. I mean, that's really old school. I mean, we don't even get those anymore. It's all email now, which makes the query a little more reductive than it had been in the past. The best advice used to be keep your query to one page. Now it's keep your query to one screen or not much more than that. And that's even less time, less space in which to actually give me a sense of your story. So that's kind of a fearful challenge to pose to writers. And I think the thing that goes wrong with most queries is that they try too hard. They try to pack too much, or they try to be gimmicky and catch my attention in clever ways. Sometimes they're really talky and friendly. You know, hey, dude, I don't think you're going to like my story, but I'm going to pitch it to you anyway. And, you know, none of that is really very effective. What is effective is getting a sense of the novel that I'm going to read. And it doesn't actually take all that much to do that. Yeah, there's the introductory part. It is a business letter in a way. And there's a little bit at the end of the query about yourself and your writing journey that's useful to know. It tells me a little bit about the human being behind the story. But in terms of conveying the story itself, actually, a lot less is needed than most people think. What I really need to know is what kind of novel am I reading or will read? What's its category, if you know that? Where's it set? That is, you know, the time and the place of the story. Who's the main character? What's the problem or conflict or thing that this character needs to do? What's the character engaged in? And then what's one way in which that any of those things twist unusually? What's different or surprising about any one of those elements? If you can do that, just give me a sense of the story, where it's set, who it's about, what's going on, and what's different about it, then I'm interested. I'm hooked. And the purpose of the query letter is not to sell me on the whole novel. It's to intrigue me just enough to request some of the manuscript to read. That's all it has to do. And if it's done that, great. Now, at my agency, most of us, there are 10 agents at my company, and most of us ask for some of the manuscript, the opening 5 pages, in my case, to be pasted into the body of the query. And I got to tell you, most of the time, I take a quick look at the body of the query, but then I scroll down very quickly to the actual writing, to the opening pages. That tells me 90% of what I want to know. And, you know, quite honestly, I know within... Well, I've been doing this a long time, so I'll confess to you that really I know within a few lines whether I'm in the hands of a really confident and relaxed storyteller or whether somebody who's a little earlier in their development. It's in the writing, really. The query is just to get me a little bit interested in that. And that's all.
Hmm.
Interesting. Thanks for that, Don. I subscribe to a bunch of publishing and writing newsletters, and it's interesting to me how much publishing has changed, especially in the last 5 or 10 years. I mean, even as you're saying that you receive queries by email, not by letter, and I'm thinking about how that even changes the process in terms of how many queries you might get. I was wondering if you could kind of point out, you know, any of the most important trends you've seen emerge, and I'm even curious, is it more or less difficult to get published now than it used to be with the kind of, I think, the access that writers have, the flood of queries you might receive?
Well, probably the most pronounced and obvious change in the last 10 years has been the advent of indie publishing, self-publishing. I mean, is there any barrier to publishing today? No, there's zero barrier. Yeah, a little bit of technical barrier to get, you know, formatted and up on the Kindle bookstore. But no, there's no impediment at all to self-publishing. I mean, there are 4,000 new titles in the Kindle bookstore every day, or at least so I'm told. So that's been one of the big changes. And it's created a big fork in the road for authors. Are you going to go the indie route, or are you going to go the traditional print publishing route? Querying agents, working with print publishers, most of them in New York, but not exclusively. So yeah, there are big choices to make there, and there are trade-offs in each direction. In the print publishing route, the traditional publishing route, the bar is much higher. The barriers are much greater. Writers talk about the gatekeepers like me, and, you know, honestly, I don't like that language. Yes, I am in the role of a gatekeeper, but it sounds like I'm there to keep the gate shut. Actually, I'm there to keep the gate open. I don't make any money shutting the gate, you know.
Right.
I only make money when I open the gate. But then there's the indie publishing route where you do everything yourself, marketing and so forth, and that's fine. And for certain categories, it can work very well. Certain temperaments thrive in the indie publishing world. Some writers and some types of stories are better off in the print realm. And it really depends. It depends on the type of story. It depends on the author and their temperament and their skills. It depends on a lot of different things. But definitely, if I look back 20, 25 years, there was only one way to get published. Today, there's every way to get published. It's just a matter of the trade-offs and, you know, what works best for you as a particular author.
Thanks so much for that, Don. It's helpful, and the world is changing fast here in publishing always. And closing, we wanted to ask you to take into account all of your experience and advice and tell us, what is the single most important concept that you'd like writers to take away as they write their books and then perhaps send them to you?
Such an easy question. So so simple to answer. Oh, goodness. I have spent 40 years working with authors to develop their careers, so obviously I've learned a lot about it. My answer is a little bit multi-part, but if you want me to boil it down to some of the most essential things to know, the first thing is that fiction careers are not, generally speaking, made with one book. Growing an audience, and indeed, growing your skill as a storyteller is a multi-book process. It's a number of titles that build an author's audience, and really an author's a voice and identity as a writer. So it's a long-term commitment, first of all. It's not just one book. The second thing is that the things that are going to make you successful as an author are not the things that people tend to focus on, particularly as they get to the stage of breaking into actual publication. It's not your agent. It's not your publisher or your imprint. It's not the cover on the book. It's not the blurbs on the back. It's not the marketing budget that you get or don't. It's not the reviews that you miss or get. None of those things are what really, truly make you successful. Consumers, book readers out there, don't know who your agent is. They don't care whose publisher's name is on the spine. The cover is nice and maybe reassuring to people, and the blurbs maybe help do that too in the physical bookstore or maybe online. They're nice. They make consumers a little more receptive. But what really hooks readers on what you're doing is what they actually read. It's all in the storytelling. If you think about it, if you go into a physical bookstore, a brick-and-mortar bookstore, and you're looking around for something to read, what do you do? Do you say, oh, well, I'm only going to pick up books that have a really cool cover? Or, gee, there better be a Stephen King quote on it, or I'm not going to buy it. You don't say things like that. What do you do? You find a book that looks like the kind of read that you want. And then you pick it up, you look at the front cover, you look at the back cover. You say, and then you open it up and you start reading. And that voice, that narrative voice, either captures you immediately or it doesn't. You know, within a page, it's often a lot less whether that's a book for you or not. And that's true with the remainder of the story. Let's say you take the book home. It's what sells it, what causes you to get excited, buy other books by that author, maybe even become one of those sort of loudmouth fans who, you know, spread the word, what we call word of mouth. It's the writing itself. Nothing matters as much as the storytelling. That is why I and everyone at my agency, and why I've spent 40 years thinking about and writing about and teaching the craft of fiction and the process of writing. Finding out who you are as a writer is as big a part of it as learning how to construct a story, how to craft a paragraph, how to work a twist, or anything else in the process. The thing that will make you successful as a writer is your storytelling. Don't get distracted by everything else. It's the story. The story is it.
The story is it.
Perfect ending, punctuated. Thank you, Don.
Oh, thank you so much, guys. It's great to talk to you. And I just want to send out good wishes and good luck to everybody at NaNoWriMo.
Yeah, thank you, Don.
We'll be right back with today's book talk.
Welcome back, everybody, for today's book talk. You know, we've talked on a few episodes about poetry, and I'm a big believer that reading and writing poetry improves your prose. So I always like to be reading a poetry book alongside my other reading, and also just because I like poetry. And I've been reading a poet I've been meaning to read for ages, Tony Hoagland, and I'm reading him in part because I know one of his friends, and in part because I've loved the few poems of his I've read over the years, and then because he actually died a few years ago, I believe. So, and what I love about his poetry, and I picked it up because he has a kind of narrative style, so I thought it would really inform my storytelling. And I love his storytelling ability and the way his poems, they meander and they sidewind, and you never quite know where you're going. Where you end up is such a surprise, and where you began. And so I'm reading his collection, What Narcissism Means to Me. And I'll just read this first stanza. I wish I could read the whole poem. It's from the poem Argentina, but this kind of, I think, sums up his writing style. Starts, "What I noticed today is the aroma of my chiropractor's breath as he moves in over my supineness, asking me where I bought those shoes, at the same instant that he wrenches my head abruptly sideways to crack my neck with a noise like popping bubble wrap." And just that one stanza, there's so much movement from the smell of the breath to the conversation, the shoes, the crack of the neck, the description of that. Anyway, this is the way his poetry moves. It's so descriptive and yet goes to surprising places. And so I recommend reading poetry and reading What Narcissism Means to Me by Tony Hoagland.
Thanks for that, Grant. And thank you to all of our listeners out there. Right Minded is a weekly podcast, so we are excited to be in your feed each week. We hope we are in your feed. And every single week, we'll bring you something inspiring, some new thing to think about. And can't wait to see you next week. So thank you.